You've all been given, I don't expect all of you to have read the article that Mary sent around that I wrote in Healthcare Analysis, but that's basically going to be largely what this talk is about. So for those of you who've read it, you'll have a lot of advance notice of what I'm going to say, and in fact, you can feel free to sleep for 25 minutes for all. But for those who don't, what I'm going to do is try and figure out a way to explore how conscience differs from other kinds of parts of a doctor's decision-making process or a healthcare professional's decision-making process, which might overlap or look like conscience in particular ways or be confused with it. I think it's probably worth outlining how I get here, largely because that might explain a little bit about why my thought processes might seem a little out of left field. So lots of people come to conscience because of interest in things like abortion or IVF, particularly from the legal sphere, because that's where the two statutory grants are. I don't really have a whole lot of interest in, I have some interest in things like abortion and IVF, but not, it's not a particular research interest of mine. Instead, I became interested in what I tend to call individual cases of conscience or individual claims of conscience, or sometimes, when I'm being colloquial, bridge too far cases. So essentially, instances in which doctors or other healthcare professionals don't normally object to a practice, that it is a practice for which they have used frequently or have no particular moral objection to, but have an objection in a particular set of circumstances. So in an instance, so in this case, under these facts at this time, I have a moral objection to doing whatever it is they're talking about. And so these are the kinds of cases I'm particularly interested in because I don't think that they generally get covered, and I don't think the general ways in which we approach conscience or have approached conscientious objection really work for those kinds of ideas. So one of the things that lots of the official guidance talks about is giving advance notice. But if these are cases which arise under a particular set of circumstances, they're not necessarily going to be an instance for which you can predict in advance, okay, I'm going to have an objection about these kinds of things. Because it might be a situation that you only realize is a problem once it arises. So how do we deal with those kinds of things? And so that's where I kind of got started, and that's why I've ended up going, okay, well, how does that differ from things like best interests or clinical judgment or those kinds of things? So this actually tends to be why I don't tend to talk an awful lot about conscientious objection as a thing. I talk about claims of conscience. And I talk about claims of conscience because what I am interested in are instances in which we want healthcare professionals, including doctors, to be able to say, my conscience is impacted by whatever it is decision we're talking about. I don't think now what that generally ends up meaning, as far as I can tell, is that the things that I would call conscience get pretty broad. And as a consequence, I don't think all of them, and I know this is straying into some territory from further roundtables down the line, but I don't think actually all of them ought, even if they're a legitimate claim of conscience, that they necessarily ought to be a thing for which we provide some sort of right or protection or those kinds of things. So it's a claim for me rather than a right or anything like that. So that's at least just a little explanation of where it is I come from. So that might hopefully explain why the other reason I'm out of left field is I'm just generally out of left field. But it might at least give some idea as to why it is I've approached these kinds of things in the way I have. Now from there, you kind of need an initial idea of what conscience is supposed to mean. And so not necessarily a definition, but at least a characterization of what it's supposed to mean. And as far as I can tell, conscience probably requires three things. The first thing it requires is some sort of conduct-related choice. So it has to be a decision. It has to be about some sort of conduct. And I'm using conduct rather than act, because I think conscience ought to apply or does apply to things we fail to do. So we might have a conscientious omission in addition to a conscientious act. I also think, by the way, and it's worth probably flagging up now, that in terms of conscience, we can act in terms not just of conscientious refusals, but in terms of conscientious provision. So we might have instances, the normal thing is, oh, there's this standard treatment that I don't want to provide. But I think there might be instances on the basis of conscience in which we say, well, look, this is something I feel like I want to provide despite other objections to it. So a standard example of that might be a doctor who, for whatever conscientious reason, wants to provide an abortion in a North American Catholic-based hospital, right, where the normal standard would be not to provide abortions, but in this particular instance, they wish to do so. So, and by choice, I just mean basically something for which you would claim authorship. So something for which I could claim this is mine. And we could get into the whole deep philosophy, you know, deep dive on philosophy there. I don't think you really need it. I think as long as it's something for which somebody would claim to be an author, it works in terms of whatever it is we're doing. So that's the first thing we probably need for conscience. The second thing is it needs to be based on a moral value. So we have all sorts of values running around. But conscience ought to be, because it's a moral claim, it ought to be based upon a moral value rather than something else. And so that's, and again, this is part of why lots of things get labeled conscience but might perhaps not be, because they aren't based on moral values, they might be based on other values. The final thing is that conscience is inward-looking. And by that I simply mean my conscience binds me, but doesn't, without any other kind of additional things, bind anybody else. So the statement, I ought not to do that because it violates my conscience, is a statement that makes sense. The statement, you ought not to do that because it violates my conscience, is not a statement that makes a lot of sense. Again, without some sort of additional work. That's all I mean by inward looking. There is a debate within the literature about the origins of conscience, and I know we're probably not going to talk too much about that, as to whether or not conscience is an individual thing or whether it is in fact socially constructed. I don't think, I'm not convinced that there's as big a debate on that as some people think there are, but more importantly, I don't think we necessarily need to worry about it overly much. So basically that leaves my characterization with a conduct-related choice based on a moral value that is inward-looking. And I said that's a pretty broad characterization of what constitutes conscience, but it's sort of deliberately there. What it isn't, so there are three things, though, that I think in my characterization of conscience aren't part of it, and I think they're deliberately not part of it. The first is it's not necessarily based on rule-based. So conscience doesn't have to be rule-based. And we actually see that quite a lot because we often think of conscience as kind of a gut feeling. Sometimes it also gets referred to as a moral nose. Things I don't like that. I don't think that's appropriate, without necessarily being able to delineate all of the rules or in any sort of systematic way as to why it is we think that might be the case. The second thing is, it's probably not always predictable. Because it's not based on rules, again, we might not be able to predict in advance when our conscience is going to hit, or how it's going to hit, or those kinds of things. Or even to the extent that we might have rules, they might not be rules which help us to in terms of prediction. So if I think, well, if this goes too far, then I'm going to have a moral objection to it. The go too far bit is hard to put a rule on. Right, that's a kind of a I know it when I see it kind of a thing. So that's the second thing. The third thing is conscience doesn't have to be correct in any sort of ideal sense, as in terms of right answers or even in terms of your own belief structure. That you can have a feeling of conscience and be wrong about it. So there's no guarantee that merely because someone has a conscientious belief that it is correct in any sort of meaning of the word. All right. If that's basically what we get to with conscience, then we've got to look at how conscience impacts upon or is part of the decision-making process of healthcare professionals. And I kind of pulled out four strands. There are probably more. There are probably a number of strands that we don't really want to consider, though. So something that, you know, becomes part of any decision-making process will be in sort of subconscious biases and those kinds of things. We're not going to spend an awful lot of time. They are probably part of decision-making processes in various ways, but not one I want to spend a lot of time with. And so we have four different strands of the general decision-making that I think we need to tease out. The first is what's often referred to as clinical judgment. I am going to borrow a term from my friend to the right here, or to the left, whatever direction you're in, and call it technical medical skill. And by that, we mean things specifically within the expertise of medical professionals. So things like, what does this drug do, constitutes technical medical skill. And I think technical medical skill is part of the decision-making process, because a doctor is unlikely to do anything in which they go, well, that's not actually going to work. But I think it's probably not going to be part of these kinds of decisions, except as it gets run into clinical judgment. So clinical judgment often ends up expanding what constitutes technical skill to all sorts of other things. And so one of the reasons to call this technical medical skill is to limit it to those things which are specifically within the expertise of healthcare professionals. The second thing that's going to be part of the decision-making process are professional requirements. And by that I mean both professional codes of conduct set down by the various regulatory agencies, the GMC, and legal codes of conduct. So it's both professional ethical codes and the legal rules which allow you or prohibit you to do particular sorts of things. And the big thing I think we want to pull out of this strand in terms of how it impacts upon doctors' decision making is that these professional codes of conduct apply whether or not the healthcare professional agrees with them. So for things in which they might decide, ooh, I think I'd actually like to do this, but I cannot because I'm constrained either by some sort of professional code or because the legal rules don't allow me to do so. That's part of the decision-making process. And it's one that applies no matter what the other kinds of strands of our decision-making are. And so you will get cases in which doctors might decide on the other three, these other three strands I'm talking about, that they think actually it ought to go ahead, but on this particular bit, they won't. So the big example I use in the article is a guy called Robert Smith. Robert Smith is a doctor up in Aberdeen, at least was, who was involved in what is now called, he was calling it amputee identity disorder at one stage, is now I think called body integrity identity disorder. Basically people for whom they think one of the limbs of their body is alien to them. And so if I have this particular condition, I might think that my right arm, despite the fact that it is part of my physical body, is alien to me and shouldn't be there. And now his response to that was that the most effective treatment, as he saw it, was to amputate the limb. So if I feel this limb is alien to me, then the most effective way to treat that would be to take the limb off. And he had all sorts of medical, this wasn't some sort of fly-by-night idea of his. He had researched it. He had a number of reasons why he believed this was the best available treatment. But the professional codes of conduct said that's not something you could do, so he didn't do it. And that was so even though he thought as a technical matter that it was appropriate as a technical response to this kind of condition, because he thought it was in the best interest, which is going to be the third one I came to, he didn't appear to have any conscientious reasons to object to it, but the professional regulation said, don't do it, so he didn't. And so it's worth realizing that the role professional codes of conduct play as part of our decision-making process. The third bit is this best interest thing. Now, I'm going to move this a little bit away. So law will limit best interest to a discussion of mental incapacity. So if you have capacity, then best interest won't apply to you. I'm going to use best interest in a broader term to simply mean what is best for the what is determined to be best for the patient, however it is we decide that. Now, best interest is a patient-focused kind of a claim. So it's a claim about what is best for this individual. What do we think is the most appropriate way to treat them on the basis of the individual characteristics that they have? So it's supposed to be a reasonably flexible, individualistic kind of decision-making idea. So, and that the focus is, in those instances, on the actual patient. Now, I think that's where the distinction between best interest and conscience comes about. Because conscience is a claim not about the patient, but about the doctor. So it becomes a claim about what it is I think I can provide if I'm a healthcare professional. And so it's focused on the professional rather than on the patient. That doesn't mean, of course, that the doctor's not paying any attention to the patient. It just means that the claim is about what conduct they can engage in, what they feel they are capable of doing, irrespective of whether or not it might, in some situation or under some definition of best interest, be best for the patient. So best interest is something for which we can have arguments and discussions about. And so it might be that I disagree with you about what best interest, and a discussion can be had on those instances. A claim of conscience will be, at least in some senses, that I don't really care about that discussion. You may be right, you may be wrong. I simply cannot provide this treatment no matter what we think the answer is on those kinds of best interest things. And so I think what healthcare professionals do, and I think healthcare professionals do it because, by the way, I think we all do this in our own professions in various different ways, is that the decisions that they reach are some combination of those four, again, and potentially more strands, but at least those four kinds of strands, that they make decisions on the basis of these kinds of things. Now, I want to be clear as to what I mean by that. I first off don't think these are completely separate discussions. So I think there's going to be an awful lot of overlap between these four strands of claims. I think it's just for a conceptual bit, you can split out the ways some of these things might be working. So I don't think that necessarily there isn't significant overlap between these kinds of things. And so what I want us to think, what I'm suggesting, is that this is just a method of analysis rather than, well, let's figure out which silo we want to place this particular decision in. And so what we end up doing is then balancing those sorts of strands to come to what constitutes our overall decision. And so we can ask individuals why it is that they reached the decisions that they reached. And so figure out what kinds of reasons they were using and how did they fit into the overall sort of process. And the final bit is that none of the strands always ends up controlling behavior, either for individuals or for groups of individuals. So for certain people, professional regulations might matter more than other groups. For other groups, professional regulations matter not overly much, and they might focus more on other things. But even within an individual, you might have a particular instance in which you think the technical medical skill is the most important part of the equation, or on other parts it might be best interests or kinds of things. Now you might ask, if this is all really complicated and it all overlaps, why on earth do it at all? And I think there are at least a couple of different, some benefits to doing so. The first is, I think it probably provides us with some benefit in terms of transparency and truthfulness. And by that I mean, when we look at these, particularly when we look at these things in a legal context, doctors are often, and healthcare professionals, or more particularly the lawyers representing them in court, have to push things down particular paths because of legal regulation. So, as I said, conscience really only gets a play legally in those statutory grants for abortion and IVF and assisted dying, if it ever makes it into a bill. So they can't really talk about conscience, even if that's really what's driving their action. And so they often end up having to force in conversations into best interest analysis, even if that's not really what they're doing. And so one of the things I think might be beneficial to using something more akin to this methodology is that it allows everybody involved to actually be truthful and transparent about what it is that influenced their decision. So in this particular case, my conscience was a crucial part of that. Now again, I am not saying that merely because you have a claim of conscience that ought to control or the behavior, that ought to control the decision. It might be an instance in which we go, okay, you have this claim of conscience, but this other thing we've got is more important. But at least allows people to be open and transparent about what it is that they think. Because it's more open and transparent, or at least it has the potential to be more open and transparent, it might provide better understanding by both healthcare professionals and patients. That healthcare professionals might better understand their own decision-making process if they were forced to kind of reflect upon it in these sorts of ways. And that then could be communicated to patients who might better understand why it is that the doctors decided to do whatever it is that they did. So you often, again, seem to get this in legal cases. Again, we only ever get the reports. But the reports seem to, at large, in various instances, be disputes between how the communication goes. That the doctors are saying one thing, which the patients are, or the patient's family, are hearing in a different kind of a way. That they hear something, so the doctor talking about burdensome treatment might be heard by patients as, oh, you want to kill my loved one. And so, again, if we were more open and transparent about the decision-making processes that form this, that might lead to some better understanding. And finally, when we have to go evaluate these, in whichever ways we have to go evaluate these sorts of things, if it's at least out in the open, we can better evaluate, well, what is happening in this particular instance, and why might we want to care about it, and why might we want to do X rather than Y. So just to kind of wrap up, what I think the model does, and it is just a model, is it sets up a system to explore claims of conscience. And it really is about it's not about trying to force decisions into particular categories. It's trying to find a way to explore and explain what it is that people are doing anyway. Now, as I said, under the model as I see it, and I've discussed this elsewhere and I'm not going to discuss it here, not all claims of conscience are subject to protection. Some of them are instances in which we go, okay, well, you believe that, you might honestly believe that, it might be a claim of conscience, but nevertheless, something else is more important. And so the goal is more about bringing it out into the open rather than necessarily an expansion of whatever rights of conscience we want to give people. And finally, that I do think in terms of this, and this is also being worked on elsewhere, is as part of this, I actually think the other element of this we got to pay some attention to is what responsibilities go alongside making a conscientious claim. So if you are going to make a claim of conscience, do you also have attendant responsibilities? I think you do, but I'm not really going to get into that. We can happily have that discussion in the roundtable if people want.